Our speaker tonight is Dan M. from Congo Big Book. Dan?
Good evening, everybody. My name's Dave and I'm an alcoholic. Or Dan. I just want to get something out of the way before I start. And that is one when Dave asked me to speak, and I told him I'd come up. And then he called me a few days ago, and he said that the group conscience asked that, you know, the speaker wear a button-down shirt. I'm like, it's not a funeral. But, you know, I was at a tradition meeting Friday night, and it was on the ninth tradition. And I know AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. How does that get me to a button-down shirt? Well, because during the course of sharing, I mentioned how, you know, as much as GSO can do in the inner groups in the areas, they can't tell one alcoholic how to do their 12-step work, nor can they tell any group how to run their affairs. And then it got to me to thinking that, you know what? The group conscience is important in my home group. So who am I not to respect the conscience of another group? So I had to put my childishness aside and wear the shirt. But another funny story, I got this shirt 16 years ago for my date with my first wife. I was dubious with my new wife. I was dubious as to whether it would fit. But we met at a club down in Philly, HP, at 3rd and Race, on a Saturday night. And we talked on the phone, and we made a date for the following Saturday night. And we met up in around 202 and 73 in a parking lot. The first thing I said when I got out is, wow, I forgot what you looked like. And then when Dave came down the steps from the business meeting tonight, I went over and introduced myself. Said, yeah, I'm Dave. He said, I'm Dave too. I'm the gentleman that spoke to you. And I was like, ooh, I didn't recognize you. So I don't know if it's the shirt that makes me bad with faces or if I'm just bad with faces. But anyhow, I'm here tonight to let you know in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I grew up down in the city of Philadelphia in a neighborhood between Honey Park and Feltonville. I'm the youngest in nine. And, my father drank, my brothers drank, my whole neighborhood drank. Drinking was just a normal part of life. But, they drank and they worked. It was frowned upon not to have a job. They're all blue collar. Now, my father and my oldest brother could do that with regularity. Me and my other brothers weren't so good at it. I got two brothers in this program. One that doesn't drink anymore. My father's deceased. But, I started drinking at the age of 13. And I had a blackout almost from the beginning. And the only reason I know that is because I was drinking with this kid in the neighborhood. We were in a playground in the back where it was dark so the cops couldn't see us. And the next day his father came over and he said, man, you were really trashed last night. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, you came crawling out of the playground on your hands and knees. I was like, ah, you're crazy. But I didn't know if he was telling the truth or not because I couldn't remember it, you know. But I didn't really think much of it, you know. And pretty much a weekend warrior through high school. My drinking progressed. It got worse. Yeah, I met a girl, another alcoholic, whose alcoholism hadn't progressed as far as mine, but now it's surpassed mine. She's down in New Orleans. That's another story. That's my ex-wife, my broken marriage. Thank you, John Barleycorn. I met her, and we had a son. You know, and I figured, maybe the responsibility will help me calm down a little bit. And far from helping me calm down, you know, my drinking got even worse. I was drinking away rent money. We were living in a house. You know, it was either the gas was shut off or the electric was shut off or we had to move out, you know, before the rent was due. You know, and this is how I was raising my son, you know, whom I was yelling at and punching the walls in the apartment when his mother would go out and not come home till 2, 3 in the morning. you know, all that good alcohol, drunken living. My anger was very bad. I was never physically abusive with him, but I was very verbally abusive and psychologically abusive. That's all part of who I am. That's where alcohol took me. I'm not saying that I poured all of that into me with a drink, but when alcohol was put on top of them flaws in me, which were basic, and discolored my personality for the worst, I was not a pleasant individual. I was disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. So the alcohol did. It discolored my personality. Made me a different person. I had to drink. I didn't realize it at the time, but I had to drink. And then when I shortly after my son was born, I guess, I don't even know when it was. He was born in 84. So maybe 85. I came around to this program down to my original home group at A Street and Wyoming Avenue. It was called the A and Wyoming Group. And my brother had been going there, my sister had been going there. So they brought me around and introduced me to people there. And my main reason for going there was to get my family back. That was my motive, I really didn't, think the booze was a big deal, So I went in there and I probably hung around maybe a year, 14 months, something like that. I was able to put together something. It was time without a drink because, there was really no step work involved. I got involved in service and tried to help them out and all and stuff like that. But it was, I had ulterior motives. And I got my family back. Like it says in the big book, we've seen men stay sober whose family never came back. We saw men who drank whose families came back too quick. I got my family back and I went back to drinking. And my drinking from there got even worse. I progressed to the point of drinking during work, drinking before work, drinking after work. I was working in blackouts. And I worked as an electroplater, so I was working around some pretty nasty chemicals. And didn't matter. The boss there, actually her stepfather was the group leader there. But there's another guy that was a supervisor. And otherwise, he was a tough guy to work for. But if you had a problem with your family and you had to run home, and you got back before the shift was over, he would pay you. So I would invent a phone call coming in so that, I could say, wow, Will, I got a problem at home. I got to run home and take care of it. And what I really took care of was the three beers I had left in my back seat. I went around to the state store, got a couple pints of rum. So I come in and have some rum and coke to get me through the night. Because some of the worst nights that I can remember were pay nights where I was standing at the clock, okay, just pacing back and forth, just waiting to get out, cash my check so I'd get to the bar. I was running on fumes, so I knew at some point I had to stop at the gas station, get some gas, get to the bar, and then, I could drink till, maybe 2, 3, they kick me out, take some beer home, go and drink till I passed out, with the thought in my mind that I want to get up as early as I can so that I can start drinking. And for another couple of years, I didn't draw a sober breath. My drinking was awful. And actually, the guy that I moved in with had an affair with my wife, and I found out about it, and it was like, well, I guess I got to move out, but I need a place to live. He had a house. He had a car. Mine wasn't running. He was three doors away from a bar, so I rented a room off him. And, it all made sense to me, he was the one I knew about. So, who knows? It was crazy. My first marriage was insane. It was steeped in alcohol. And that's why it was insane. I had a daughter along the way, the first time I got sober. And I came back into the rooms. I crawled back into the rooms in Wyoming in 1990. I think they found me passed out at work. And my boss told me that, that was it. I had to go do something. And I'm like, all right. So they sent me home, and I remember coming to in the parking lot, and there's my boss, the plant manager, the security guard, and the guy I work with. And I'm going, how did they get here? And I was like, where am I at? And I realized once again I had made it to my car, but never made it any further. I passed out in the front seat. I would do that with regularity, leaving the bar to go to my buddy's house, someone waking me up a couple hours later. You know, I'm thinking I'm a lightweight. Here it is. I've been drinking for the last 3 or 4 days. I can remember, you know, I had a drink an hour ago. I might not have had a meal 48 hours ago. You know, and I mean, that's how I was living. You know, it was total insanity. You know, I was living to drink, and I didn't realize that I had to drink. I didn't know. I mean, you know, yeah, I could sit at the bar and say, hey, I'm an alcoholic, give me another one. But I didn't understand what it meant to be alcoholic. You know, so I crawled back in these rooms, and I figured, maybe I can crawl back in here as bad as it was. And these guys, maybe they can help me straighten out these problems to get all this stuff off my back. And then I can go drink in peace, because I was getting no peace from my drinking. But fortunately, these guys here told me I had the cart before the horse. You know, and that it was my drinking causing my problems. Not the other way around. You know, and it was like, all right, I kept coming around. You know, I seen some guys there from before. I ran into my buddy. They were calling him White Chip Mike because he was always in and out getting white chips. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the chip system, but down in the city, you get a white chip for 0 to 30, 29 days, a red chip, a blue chip, I think, for 30 to 59, and a red chip if you're over 60 days. And he had a collection of white chips. I stopped collecting mine. But, you know, I started hanging out with him, and, you know, and him and a couple guys took me under their wing, and, you know, so I kept hanging around, and, you know, and I mean, I was insane, totally insane. My head ran constantly. You know, these guys would go out, we'd be sitting there watching a movie, and this would be me on the chair. I couldn't sit still. It was alcohol. I didn't know what it was. You know, I had a guy tell me, he goes, you know, you come around here, you come into me, oh, this room's smoky. You know, that guy's a pain. Oh, I don't like that one. He said, it's alcohol. It's booze trying to call me back in. And I didn't realize it. See, because to me, booze doesn't come to me in a bottle and a glass. Because if it came to me in the form of a bottle and a glass, it wouldn't be very cunning. And alcohol is very cunning. And my desire to drink for the first 4 or 5 months that I was sober was me with my foot on my ex-wife's throat. That hatred and that resentment, man, fueled. It just ran around. I used to have to sleep with the television on because I just couldn't quiet the voices in my head. It was just panic attacks. You know, I'd wake up in the middle of the night. I woke up one night and I was completely paralyzed. Absolutely paralyzed, and I had to wait for a couple minutes to realize that I was still actually breathing. I couldn't even feel myself breathing. I mean, it was awful. It was awful coming back around here, you know. And even at that bed, you know what I mean? It's still, oh man, not even one drink. You guys are a little drastic. Well, you know what? I didn't take one drink, and I always thought that, you know, like things could never be different for me. It was always going to be this life of being in one jackpot after another and always screwing up at exactly the wrong time and always blowing every opportunity I had, and it'd never be different. And at some point, I don't know when it was, I got that spark of hope. And that spark of hope is what they refer to in the big book is what at first appeared a flimsy reed proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And I believe in all my heart that that's what it is. And I am not a religious guy, but I have absolutely no problem with God. There is a God who works in my life. I know it because I'm standing here tonight. And it's only by the grace of God that I'm standing here tonight. And then I remember one night I'm in work and absolute in a panic. I get on the phone, I call this guy Harley George that I've been talking to. He was a crazy character. And so I get him on the phone and I'm telling him all these things that are wrong. Oh, my ex this one, that, and he goes, I'll tell you what you do. So you go home, you draw yourself a warm bath, get in there and read step two. And I went, man, this guy didn't listen to a word I said. And then I was like, oh, you know what? I am calling him on the phone. So, all right. So I went home. I wasn't ever one for baths, But I did read step two. Showers. Whoa. Okay. I'm not a bumpkin, that's for sure. So I read step two. And, you know, that night I didn't have to sleep with the TV on. I got a peaceful night's sleep. You know, it was like, I don't know, God, if you're up there, if you're down here, I don't know. I was raised in a religion, and so, you know, the fact that there was a God is fine. And I'm not blaming them for my relationship or lack of faith. It has nothing to do with it. You know, maybe I wasn't listening. But all I knew was any time you looked up in the sky, and, you know, and God, you know, if you're there, I could just use some help. You know, and I got a good night's sleep. And that's when things, ooh, okay, maybe this does work. But I still didn't quite get this concept of powerless. I knew what unmanageability was. My life was a train wreck. And just because I stopped drinking didn't mean everything stopped in midair. It was crashing down around me between going down to traffic court, going down to family court, probation at my job for 2 years. They could do a urinalysis and breathalyzer. Just all the insanity, you know, it didn't just stop. And, wow. You know, that was one of the things that attracted me to the guys when I came back around is, you know, they took the time to talk to me and to give me rides home, you know, and I had nothing. I had nothing to offer these guys. I mean, I wore the same clothes that I worked in, you know, and they stunk of chemicals. And I was a wreck. But they took the time to talk to me, and it was like, there's no way these guys could have been standing where I'm standing now. It's not possible. But when they were talking to me, it was like, then how do they know all this stuff? I didn't tell them. But, you know, their clothes were clean. Their eyes were bright. They had a little bit of money in their pocket. They had homes to go to. And the most important thing is their licenses were valid. Their cars were registered and inspected. And insured. Because I never did any of that. I just needed a number to write down. I didn't need insurance. That was drinking money. Stickers I just bought. You know, and a license, who cares? I don't need a license to drive. I need a car. And that's how, you know, and that's how I lived. You know, I drove like this plenty of nights. How I never got a DUI, I don't know. I was pulled over, and for some reason the cop let me go. I don't know why. The grace of God, that's all I can say. You know? I know in my heart I couldn't get away with it any more than I could get away with a drink right now. So that's all there is to that. That's not a qualification. But anyway, I got to the point now, I moved up around Glenside because I worked in Jenkintown. And I was going to meetings at the Glenside Center. And that's where I met my sponsor, the man who taught me how to work the steps, who taught me how to get sober, stay sober, and live sober. Guy is still my sponsor today, some 18 and a half years later. And, you know, it was one day where I was down at the bottom of the steps. It was in the Social Security building on Eastern Road. You had to go around the back and down the steps and then through another door into the room. And I was standing at the bottom of those steps, and I felt like an absolute blank tape. I had no idea who I was, what I was doing, where I was going, nothing. Everything that I knew was gone, and I had no idea what tomorrow brought. And I was like, you know what? My whole life has been fueled by self-will and alcohol. And if I don't want that life, I don't think God does. Here's something I forgot to tell you. The first time I came around here, when I came in the room, they had the steps and the traditions on the wall. And I came in, I read down, I got the number 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and 5, admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And the first thing that came to my mind is, I'll never do that. That may be okay for you people in here, but nobody's getting up here. Nobody. Where I come from, you don't tell people what's going on. You hide it from the neighbors. Whether they know it or not, it doesn't matter. You just don't tell your business. They'll find out, but you don't tell. You just don't do it. And that's what I said the first time. And like I said, that time, I picked up a drink. This time, if I was truly going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understood Him, then I was going to have to do that which I said I would never do. And that's the whole essence of step 3, is steps 4 through 12. Absolutely. And it even says in the third step, you know, how effectively we work the rest of AA's 12 steps will depend on how well we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Because if I'm not truly going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, it's not going to be possible for me to do a searching and fearless moral inventory. I'm dishonest and I'm unmanageable. I can't do an honest and searching fearless moral inventory. Can't do it. But with the help of God, I can. And so my sponsor told me, you get out the big book and you go to How It Works, and you read the step, you read the fourth step in there. And you got your list, you got your resentments, you got your fears, and you got your sexual inventory. And then when you get all that down, we'll go into the step book, we'll go into step four, and all the way in the back, starting, I forget what page it is, in the first paragraph for 11 questions, you start writing them out and answering them. So I went to writing this down. You know, like it says, you know, with the resentment list, after we get it done, it says to see where other people were wrong as far as most of us got. And that was pretty much where I got to. You know, well, I'm mad at such and such because they did this to me and it made me feel like this. It made me feel like a punk, or it made me feel, you know, less than, or, you know what I mean? And that was my resentment list, of course. I had to get it out of the way to go back and take a look at it and look at my part. And then my fears. And I didn't realize I had so many fears till I was able to make a list of them. You know, they had nothing to do with drinking, nothing to do with resentments. They were just fears. You know, and they say, you know, fear ought to be classed with stealing. You know. And then the sexual inventory was, well, actually what if it's steps four, so that's all well and good. And then I was writing out all these questions, and I got more coming to mind. I'm writing and writing, and after, I don't know, a month and a half, I'm like, man, Jesus, I'm finally done. So I go over, and I go over to my sponsor's house, and we're sitting across his table up in the room, and he had the upper, you know, the attic that he made into his office. He was self-employed. So we're sitting there, and I told him, well, you know what, Johnny, there were some questions all the way in the back that I didn't answer. Man, and you went, whoa, that's a half measure. I thought the book was on fire. And he goes, well, let's go see what you thought wasn't so important. So we went back and it said, alcoholics who drunk themselves out of family and friends need to cross-examine themselves ruthlessly. And he said, did you drink yourself out of family and friends? I said, yeah. He said, then why do you think you don't have to do this? So back I went to writing a little more. And came back and I sat down with him and back across that table, and I'm telling him my inventory, and my head kept sinking a little bit more. My voice is kind of low. I'm hanging my head down, and he told me, he said, you pick your head up, you're becoming a free man. You know? And that's what I did, and I was able to get this crap out, all this garbage. And it was then, when I did the fifth step, that I was like, oh my God, this is what they mean by powerless. This is what they mean by alcohol running every aspect of my life. That's how baffling it is. Told me where to go, when to go, why to go. If you didn't have booze, I wasn't going. That's all there is to it. If there wasn't drinking there, I wasn't going. If I was forced to go, I was leaving as soon as I could. You know, that was it. Alcohol was everything. And I didn't even see it. Man, there's no denial. I can't deny that which I don't know. That's what they say. That's the baffling feature of this malady. The utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. I can wish to leave it alone all I want. But until I understand what I'm dealing with, I don't have a prayer. Absolutely none. And this was a step that really started to change my personality. This is the one that got in and really started to let me see what was going on. This is the step that started to arrest my alcoholism. But I couldn't stop there. I tell guys I sponsor today, you don't finish an 8-step, then your inventory isn't done. And if you don't get as fast and as far as you can on a 9-step, your past is not truly behind you. You know, because then I had to go make a list of my defects and then take it to him, and he had to tell me whether or not I was right. You know, and then I got the shortcomings, that knot in my stomach when I should do something or I shouldn't do something, and it's fear. And that's what the shortcoming is. It's total fear. And fear is an activator, the chief activator of character defects. And whenever I get that self-centered fear, either I'm not going to get something I want or I'm going to lose something I already have, man, my defects come out. And I'm a defective individual. I will not kid you. Absolutely not. And then I get to an eighth step. And man, the eighth step, what a great step that is. When you can forget about the ninth step and just get to the essence of the eighth step of making a list, made a list of persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And when I'm making, when I was making out this list, I could go back through my life, just go back through my life. And I learned more about my personality and what made me tick in my eighth step than I did in my fourth step. I saw all these things back before I ever picked up a drink. Cynical, sarcastic, sneaky, a liar, a thief. I didn't pour all that stuff in with alcohol. Alcohol just enhanced it. You know, alcohol just brought out all the worst. You know, alcohol got into them flaws that were basic and discolored them for the worse. I didn't pour all my defects into me with a bottle. Some of them, yeah. Most of them, no. Most of them, no. I know because I still got a lot of work to do. You know, and then the ninth step, and going out here facing people again, you know, and trying to make it right, and going down to the courts and making it right there, and trying to make it right with my kids. And man, that took a while. There was a lot of guilt. A lot of guilt that I had surrounding my kids, you know, where I probably maybe did stuff I shouldn't have done because I was feeling guilty. But, you know, the time came, I remember when my son was 18 years old, he gets arrested for helping some knucklehead light an abandoned house on fire. So now he's in there for conspiracy to arson. He's 18 years old and he's in jail. So I get down to visit him. I'm going down to visit them every week, bringing them some money. I'm trying to talk to them, you know. He finally gets sentenced. So he's time served. He gets out, you know. Okay, so I get him a job. I take him to get his license. I get him a car. In about 3 months, it's all gone. And it's like, you know what? The slate's clean, man. You're on your own now. You get a higher power, and he's got to look out for me because I can't do anymore. And right there, it was like, man, wow, the freedom of that guilt was really finally gone. And I even had to make amends to my ex-wife. And I'll tell you, as I stand here today, I would have rather stuck a hot needle in my eye than went and made amends to that woman. And it wasn't until I became willing to do it that I was able to do it. And even my wife, during our marriage, she goes, you know what? You got to get rid of that resentment or it's going to eat you up. And I said, I don't resent her. I just hate her. I mean, you know, I say that and it sounds funny, but I'll tell you what, I suffered longer than I needed to. I really did, you know, but until we become willing, you know, it's not going to work. You know, there's a difference between going through the steps and going through the motions. And I couldn't just go through the motions. If it wasn't in my heart, it wasn't going to count. It's a difference between head knowledge and heart knowledge. And a 10th step. Guys, the best way to do a 10th step is to get married. I tell you what, man, I don't have one defect that goes unnoticed. I have a wife, twin teenage daughters, and a mother-in-law in my house. I used to have a male dog and he died. Now I even have two female dogs in my house. So, you know, but I do. It's constantly always looking at myself and checking my motives. And, you know, even if something as dumb as a shirt, even if something dumb as one day I'm in Redner's and you know what, I'm just like, you know what, man, I'm tight on money. I hate how much they're charging for this fruit. You know what? I'm going to get the number off of the stickers here, this stuff that's cheaper, and put this in. And when I'm going home, I'm going, you know what? What a dope. I sold a piece of my soul for a couple measly bucks. And that's all that I did. I don't get away with it. There's no free lunch. It doesn't matter. You know, there's days where I got to ask myself, is this worth a piece of my soul? Some days the answer is yes. Most days the answer is no. There was a time early on where I would have thought nothing of pirating cable TV. They got it coming to them. You know what I mean? But then I had another family of two kids I had. You know what I mean? I have to be an example. I can't live in a vacuum anymore. I have to, all my actions affect other people. They affect the people around me, just like my alcoholism did. You know, and that's just the way it goes, and the onus is on me. You know, and believe me, I'm not perfect at it. I am a flawed individual. The more I see, the more work I need to do, but it's okay because I have this program. You know, and then the 11th step with the prayer and meditation and the knowledge of God's will for us. And Aaron goes, well, what's God's will and what's not? Well, it says right in there that all of AA's 12 steps require sustained and personal exertion to conform to their principles, and so we trust to God's will. So if I turn to the 12 steps when I'm going through something, then I can trust that I'm trying to do God's will, because never in there does it say, yeah, Dave, you're right. Harbor that grudge. Yeah, you're right. Get even with that guy. Yeah, you're right. Take that. You deserve it. Never. It tells me all the opposite. Forgiveness and tolerance and understanding and kindness and love and all that stuff that is not innate to me. You know, or I don't believe is innate to the alcoholic. Not a person like me who's lived a life of self-centeredness. You know, it's every day I have to work against that self-centeredness. You know, I was ambivalent about coming all the way out to Quakertown. I'm like, but you know what? No, I said I would do it. You know what I mean? When I make a commitment, I stick to it. You know? And it's like, I know at the end of the night, I'm going to be better off for it. Because that's how it always works. You know, in the 12th step, when my phone rings, and sometimes, man, he's out. It's like, some of these guys can really suck your soul out. But you know what? It's like, but it's like, you know what? I was that guy at one time, and no one ever turned me away. No one ever told me when I came back in after I drank, you know what? You can't be here. You know, they all said, you know, you kept it green. Welcome back. You know, but, you know, they never said, no, go, you drank. This is where we come to. This is the last stop. That's what they told me. This is the last chance saloon that they talk about. This is the last stop between an alcoholic and a horrible death or a life of insanity. Right here. Right here. In these rooms. This is where I found my life. This is where I found my way of life. You know, and as a result of that, I'm living a life today that I was incapable of living. Even 17 years ago. Because every year it just gets a little bit better. And each day it just gets a little bit better. And a little bit more understanding. A little bit more effectiveness. And, you know, and just like alcoholism is progressively fatal and always gets worse over time, never better, I believe practicing these 12 steps, we get better over time. Absolutely. Can't help but do it. You know, the more I clear up, the longer I'm away from the drink, you know, the more I want to live this way of life. You know, the more my idea of tolerance changes, the more my idea of what honesty is changes. You know, the more my relationship with God gets just a little bit better. And I can't explain God to you like I can explain it. You know, a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. I can't put it that simply. But you know what? I know there's a God in my life. I know it because I'm sitting here tonight. Speaking at a meeting. You know, he used to tell me that in AA Wyoming, you should be glad that life isn't fair. Because if you got what you deserved, you wouldn't be sitting here with us. You know, I come in there and tell them, I had a bad day today. They said, well, now you'll know what a good day feels like. Then come in and tell them you're having a good day. They go, that's nice. Who are you helping? You know, and that's, you know, and it was all, you know, with love. It was never like they were looking down on you or, you know, or talking down to you. But it was all about, you know, we don't take ourselves real seriously, but we take this very seriously. And I have to. I have to take my sobriety seriously. Because although my alcoholism is arrested, I'm not cured. That's the difference between recovered and cured. Cured means, oh, then I'm not an alcoholic anymore. But that's not the case. I know the way I think, and the way I think about alcohol isn't like normal people think. Absolutely not. You know, but I've recovered health. I've recovered sanity. Second step guarantees that to me. You know, and that's what it says. You know that, you know, the power came to believe the power greater than self could restore. Not would, could. God couldn't would if he were sought. You know, and that's what these 12 steps are for me to find a power greater than myself that would solve my problems. And as a result of that, I'm able to be a husband today. I'm able to be a father today. I'm able to be a friend today. I'm able to be an employee today. You know, I'm able to be a functional member of society. You know, I've had some things happen. My wife, man, Jesus. She goes through the mill. You women, man, you got my sympathy. She's been through the mill with medical problems. It's just unbelievable. You know, but it's life. You know what I mean? And I've had stuff happen. I never get into an accident with a drunk driver until I get sober. Then I get hit on Christmas Eve when I get rear-ended. And then about 4 years ago, a guy crashes through my living room and hits me on my sofa. Knocks me into a wall. And I stumble out the door and I look at this guy and I go, man, he's drunk. I can tell. I can tell the way he's... I'm like, oh, he's drunk. I'm getting, you know... And, you know, my whole life was always like, I always define life as comedy and tragedy this way. Tragedy is when I fell down the steps. Comedy is when someone else did. And if it didn't happen to me, it didn't happen. And if it didn't matter to me, it didn't matter. And then I don't know why these things happen, but I don't know how to. I don't have to know why. I heard a guy from the Young Men's. He came in one night. He was in the meeting. And he said, you know, life is funny. And he recounted a story, and it was about a rancher who had a ranch on the outskirts of town. And one day, he had a horse ranch, and one day his prize mare ran away. And all the townspeople came running up, and they were like, this is terrible. This is terrible what happened that your prize mare ran away. And the guy said, I don't know if it's bad, and I don't know if it's good. I just know that it is. 2 days later, the mayor came back and brought all these valuable wild Mustangs. And he got them all corralled in, and the townspeople came running again, and they said, this is great. This is great that your mayor came back and brought all these Mustangs. And once again, he said, I don't know if it's good, and I don't know if it's bad. I just know that it is. And the next day, his son was out there helping him break one of these horses in, and it threw him off, and it kicked him, and busted up his ribs, his legs, his arms. I mean, it busted the kid all up. Once again, here come the townspeople telling them, this is terrible. What happened to your son? And once again, he said, I don't know if it's good, and I don't know if it's bad. I just know that it is. And the next day, the army came around conscripting all the young men to go fight in the war with another village. And when they saw a son there, they didn't want nothing to do with him. So they left him. And once again, the villagers came running. This is great. This is great that the army didn't take your son away. And once again, he said, I don't know if it's good, and I don't know if it's bad. I just know that it is. And when these things happen, I don't know at the time if they're really good or if they're bad. I don't know what God's plan is. But what I do know is that if I stay sober, and if I keep coming around and putting one foot in front of another, eventually my path will intersect with the path of someone else who's going through the same trouble that I went through. And then I can share my experience, strength, and hope with them, and hopefully help them avert a little bit of misery. And usually it isn't by telling them what to do. It's usually by telling them all the mistakes that I made. Listen, you know, this is what I did. And, you know, it really blew up on me. These are the mistakes that I made. You know, you don't have to make these mistakes. You can learn from mine. You know, that was one of the... And when that happens, then I truly get one of the greatest gifts of all. And that's the chance to be truly useful to another human being. And for a guy who's lived a completely self-centered life for so long, man, that's truly a miracle. Absolutely a miracle. This is not a theory. I have to live it. I have to live it because the alternative for me is to go down a path I don't want to get down. You know, and before the drink comes, there's a lot of stuff that happens. And then the sanity goes. The insanity returns and we drink again. And for us, to drink is to die. And I don't want to drink today. Absolutely not. I love sobriety too much. I stopped drinking when I had nothing to lose. Why would I start drinking now when God gave me such a rich, full life? That's all I got.